So basically 400 giga cubic kilometers.
Welcome to Further Research Needed. We bring Tavla journalism to the academic world. This is the podcast with straightforward questions and not so straightforward answers. I'm Hannes Feirer and I'm joined by
Jan-Philipp Reising
and Christopher Wood.
Today we play one of our guessing games, which means I asked each of the other two people to bring a number to the table, which we are supposed to guess. And of course, we're supposed to use scientific approaches, and I hope we can illustrate and apply what we have learned in our lives as a scientist and the way of scientific thinking in order to answer these questions and or provide a guess in the ballpark, I would say.
Yeah, I'm excited. This is going to be great.
What have you brought, Chris?
Okay.
I want to say Philip, just not the wrong name. What did you bring, Chris?
Okay, so thank you for that brilliant introduction. However, my guessing game is not based on a single number. It's more a ranking. This is all based on a concept of your public perception, or the public's perception of risk. And in fact, there's a professorship in Cambridge for the public perception of risk, and also how to illustrate risk to the public. So this comes off the back of something, a concept that I've just been reading about called the micromort, which is a unit of risk defined as a 1 in 1 million chance of death. So I think vaguely people know about these sorts of things.
So one micromort would be a 1 in 1 million chance.
Yeah. Of death.
So one mort would be
a 1,000.
A 1 in 1 chance?
A 1 in 1,000 chance.
And we
no
micro
is 10^-6.
Yeah. So yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So first of all, as a warm up to this exercise, I'd like you to rank the traveling 100 miles. By these four modes of transport. So you have traveling by jet, walking, traveling by car, or traveling by motorbike. So which do you think would be the most risky?
Jet, walking,
and car.
Which one was the car? Jet, walking, car, and motorbike.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is fine. And it's per distance traveled, so per 100,000.
So yeah, it's exactly the same distance on all of them. Because the problem is that you travel a lot further on a jet than you do by walking.
Really. Yeah,
I feel like I had this conversation with Philip someday.
Yeah, we discussed before. I feel like I'm at an advantage here. I feel like I've done my homework.
This is fine. This is just the intro. This is just to get warmed up, and then we're going to get into real life choices after this.
Right.
Oh, this is going to be fun.
Okay, I think I know the least, so I'm just going to guess. I'm going to guess motorbike, mm-hmm. walking, car, and jet.
Do you agree?
Okay, I'm going to go just for the sake of the argument. So motorbike is the most dangerous, and then I would say car, walking, jet. So basically B and C switched. I think it's more dangerous in the car than walking.
Okay, interesting.
Ah, but you're walking so long, right? Oh no, I'm going to stick with it.
You should have twisted. Hannes is correct. So, by far the most safe form of travel is traveling by jet. Your risk of dying by jet, or the number of micromorts if per 100 miles traveled by jet is 0.1. So that's the safest. Then car, which I'm a bit surprised about, but I suppose walking also incorporates like being tripping in your home, all of those sorts of things. Being run over by a car counts as dying by walking, not so on and so forth. So I think that makes sense. And then yes, motorbike is the most dangerous form of transport. It's a whopping 16.6 micromorts compared to 5.8 for the next most dangerous, which is walking. So really don't take a motorbike.
Wow.
I think the discussion Hannes and I had were that if you calculate it for time, it looks quite different. I think the thing is you spend like a couple of hours on a plane, but if you'd walk 100,000 kilometers, you would spend like a very long time. So
I think if you
calculate it by time, the it looks quite different.
And this is the interesting kind of thing about the public perception of risk. You have to be careful about how you quantify or how you express the risk to people, because you could twist the numbers by changing the per unit time, per unit, so on and so forth. So that's kind of it. Okay, so that's fine. I think in general, that's kind of known about which transport level is most dangerous. So now I want to test you on the life choices you're making. And no judgments here, but I would like you to rank smoking a pack of cigarettes, drinking 5 liters of wine, eating 500 steaks, spending 12 hours in a coal mine, taking one tablet of ecstasy, hang gliding, and giving birth.
Can you repeat them quickly so I can also write them down?
Mm-hmm, sure. So the first one is one smoking a pack of
pack
cigarettes.
5 liter wine.
5 liters of wine. 500 mm-hmm. blackened steaks, like really quite well cooked, or at least having charcoal on the outside of them. Spending 12 hours in a coal mine. Taking a tablet of ecstasy. Hang gliding, and giving birth. That's one trip hang gliding.
Sorry, hang gliding? What?
Hang gliding. Like
what is that again?
When you strap the kind of long wing made of fabric to your back and jump off a mountain.
Was there a unit to that?
Just one trip.
Okay.
So where are you giving birth? Because I know there's a big difference between the US and Europe.
Oh man, I just got this off Wikipedia. This is dangerous. Dude, don't ask me. I think, one second.
But I think,
you should just use the number you got, whatever.
I think
we can play it like this, but I'm going to contest any kind of result because if you're giving birth in the US, in India, or in Germany, it's going to be a big difference.
Wait, where's my... The book it comes from is published in London, but I can't tell you where they got their statistics. So I'm going to say in the UK, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Right.
Oh, this one is tricky. There's also a lot of options here.
Mm-hmm.
We should rank all of these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
That's...
So taking tablet of ecstasy is not dangerous at all.
I would also say that.
Basically
zero. Now...
Well, so
I'm not sure if I want to say this in public because I sound like I'm advocating hard drugs, but as a biochemist, I see a very limited long-term risk.
So it's your chance of dying, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think you can really die from one. I mean, so the question is, if you get a bad ecstasy tablet and there's something else in there, then the risk assessment is quite different, right?
This is really impressive. I'll tell you at the end why that's cool. I like it.
So that's it. So we're talking about the real life risk, right? You're going, whatever, to Burning Man and a guy sells you a tablet of ecstasy and you don't know what it is. We're not talking about, I'm going to Sigma and buying like 100% pure.
Yeah, this is real world risk. This is based on death data, the number of people who've done it and died.
Right. Okay, that's, I guess, that puts all the socioeconomic factors in the equation.
Yeah, I think that ecstasy might be more dangerous than I thought it would be.
Right, yeah. Mm.
Are we talking about drinking 5 liters of wine in one sitting?
So this is in particular related to the risk of cirrhosis. So it's not all of the other potential risk factors, even just like walking drunk or drunk driving, that doesn't get included in this. This is just for the risk factor of getting liver cancer. Cirrhosis of the liver.
But then we're talking like continuous consumption, right? It's not like I'm drinking 5 liters in my whole life.
But the way the micromort breaks that down is it tells you the risk of having done that thing. So drinking that 5 liters is something million in one chance of dying or increasing that risk.
This is super difficult.
But this must be so small for alcohol and smoking. If you drank 5 liters of wine in your entire life, I don't think your risk for liver cirrhosis would go up that much.
But you're talking across the population of drinking the wine.
Hmm.
I'm going to have to push you guys. I think we're going to go now more for a gut reaction to these things.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm about to write down my gut reaction.
Okay.
And we're talking modern coal mine or like 1800 coal mine without...
The contents are the same. It's just how you're protected, I guess.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Hmm.
There is, I do recommend going and reading the Wikipedia article for micromorts, because this is where all this data is based off. And it does talk
later
about your risk of dying in different eras. So between 1800 and 1901 and 1901 to 2000. It's kind of cool. Okay, three, two, four.
No. Okay, give me like maybe 10, 15 more seconds. I haven't even started writing down numbers.
You're right here in Burning Man. I'm handing you an MDMA tablet and you're like, no, wait, I need to assess the risk. Come on.
Okay, let's go.
It's either me with the MDMA tablet or the guy next to him with 500 steaks. Or the other guy with 5 liters of wine. Come on. Okay, Hannes.
I'm going to take the MDMA tablet
The
500 sticks. Not first, but over the 500 sticks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Really?
Yeah. 500 sticks. Blackened, like fried until they're black. That's so much acrylamide. And that's all I'm terrified of in the lab, right? Acrylamide and ethylene bromide. Literally two things I'm afraid of.
Not the methanol you spray the ethanol.
Sorry?
You liberally spray ethanol all over the lab, but hey,
that's
fine.
We do. Literally do.
So I can't change my list now, right? If Hannes convinces me, then...
You can change.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Uh-huh. So I put... Maybe because I spray my lab with ethanol every day, maybe that's why I put the 5 liters of wine lowest on the list as the safest things to consume.
Okay.
Followed by the one pack of cigarettes, because it seems like a rather low amount compared to how much people consume, how much I see people consume. Mm-hmm. 12 hours in a coal mine also doesn't seem like a lot of time for me, mm-hmm. considering people spend years in those and they have severe health effects of that, mm-hmm. but 12 hours seems like a manageable time. Then I go on with a tablet of ecstasy, which I think is a safe product in itself, but if you look at all the other factors around it, I can see that there is quite a risk associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
Then I, as third, like the third riskiest item on this list, I put giving birth, because
mm-hmm.
I think it's a rather risky procedure in itself, and only because of modern medicine it is quite safe today.
Okay.
But as Philip said, it really depends where the data comes from. What I really wouldn't want to do is eat 500 steaks.
Oh wow, okay.
That sounds quite bad, especially when they're fried till they're black all around. And what I really, really wouldn't want to do is hang gliding.
Oh,
also because
wow.
I'm terrified of heights.
Okay, interesting.
I seem to be quite off here.
Philip, how are you going
to
go?
I would not bet money on this. Let's put it this way.
Okay.
I'm going to go the other way. So basically, I think the most dangerous thing is hang gliding as well.
Wow.
Then I'm going with the coal mine. So I'm assuming that you don't have any protection or anything. If you just go down there, I think it's quite dangerous. Like, I'm just going off, like, do I know of people who have died? Like, how far removed would I have to go to find someone who died of that thing? And I feel like coal mine injuries is rather close. Also, they get a lot of money. I think it's dangerous. And then birth is also my third, because I feel like you could find someone who died giving birth rather easily. Then I'm going smoking, drinking, and the steaks. But I think Hannes might be right that 500 steaks are a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going ecstasy tablet. But I think that one, ecstasy tablet might be a bit higher, but I think it might be lower than people think.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's my guess. I'm excited.
Okay. Interesting.
This is a really fun game.
This is interesting because we probably should get a gender equal podcast to test this one out, because you two were way off on one of them, and that one's giving birth. By far,
okay,
the most risky thing you can do is give birth. It counts as 120 micromorts.
We had number three.
This was my initial reaction, but
we're
figured
not that far off.
So 120 micromorts. Apparently, for vaginal birth is 120, and then for cesarean is 170. And I think the reason for the risk, the increased for that number, is because you tend to give cesarean sections when there's risks in at birth. Yeah. So there's some other complicating factor going on, and then they go to cesarean birth. So that's a bit of an unfair number to compare against if you were trying to choose between the two. But anyway, so that's 120, 170. Then the next highest on the list is spending 12 hours in a coal mine, but that is 10 times less risky than giving birth. Okay?
Wow.
So that's 16 micromorts. Okay? The next one is to smoke a pack of cigarettes.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Way off.
So the spending time in the coal mine was a combination of the two risks: by getting black lung disease, which is inhaling the particles of carbon, and also the accident risk in a coal mine. Smoking a pack of cigarettes is the combined cancer and heart disease death rate, so that's 14. The next one is where we can have a discussion about MDMA, because the risk of MDMA is between 0.5 and 13. And it depends on whether you've been taking other drugs at the same time or drinking.
That makes a lot of sense.
And then drinking 5 liters of wine is 10. So depending on what you're up to, and probably if you combine the two, the risks are way higher. And then the least dangerous would be hang gliding or ecstasy, depending on where you take the ecstasy number. But it's 8 micromorts for hang gliding. So you both really fear hang gliding. It's interesting.
But what about,
sorry,
what
where
about
was the stakes?
Exactly.
The stakes come in at 5. Oh, wait, I completely forgot about the stakes. The stakes are the least dangerous. Sorry.
Oh,
I missed out.
So
7.
It's hang gliding and then stakes.
Yeah.
Huh.
I think because
very interesting.
The stakes, it's an interesting one because it's like you still have to eat stuff and it would have been cooked anyway. So this is, I don't know, it's an interesting one where you measure that risk, an increased level of risk as well on that one.
Right. How is it different from 500 black fried zucchini?
Exactly. Who knows? The Wikipedia article not look into zucchini levels of risk.
Interesting.
But actually, I have to say, I'm quite happy with my... I think I wasn't too far off. I mean, we can discuss birth if Hannes and I take 3 and it's actually 1.
I think
the number is so much higher. I think
rating
might be a bit...
I think what is always more interesting, or the most interesting thing in these guesses, is how people try to assess a number or estimate a number or assess a risk in this case, is that Philip's method apparently was... Does he know anyone who died caused by this item on the list? While mine was rather, how much do I see people do this, and do they seem to die, or does it seem to be condemned by society and healthcare?
I did like
giving
birth, obviously,
isn't, but that's a very bad way to do it, because ecstasy, and I think also why steak got us, is that it's like exactly at that point, society is not making a very good risk assessment.
Yeah, exactly. At this point, it's super biased.
Apparently, this like, blackened meat kind of thing is crazy in the media and doesn't have that much of a backing behind it, while ecstasy is the reverse. Like,
yeah.
So I did, to continue your point, Hannes, I did like that Philip chose the risks based on, did he know anyone who died of it? How many coal miners do you know?
No, so not how many I died. I was thinking like how far removed would you have, I'm assuming, would you have to go to find someone?
Right.
Cool. So I think finding someone who died of birth would be like maybe 3 levels removed maximum. Mm-hmm. Maybe just 2. So maybe from that I should have just put it first. But yeah, I mean, coal mines, it's interesting that it's so dangerous. Yeah, this was really fun. Oh, this is this is nice. And it's very educational because you never kind of fact check your risk assessment, right? You just have those risk assessments and then you never like actually look into the data.
So the final end to this is I recommend everyone read the Wikipedia article on what's called a micro life, which counts as the unit of risk representing half an hour change of life expectancy. And it's quite interesting. So you can talk about, say, smoking 15 to 24 cigarettes. In for men, that represents minus 10 microlives. So that's 300 minutes of your life decreased by doing that. Then for alcohol, the first drink is actually plus one microlife. So you're increasing your lifespan by 30 minutes. But then the subsequent drink is minus a half for men. So minus 15 minutes.
But I'm not sure about that one. I don't know how much of that funding is like. That's like the one glass of wine theory, right? And I'm not sure how well that was funded by the French Wine Association or something.
Right. That's a cheap argument which I wouldn't want to make, but interesting that Chris found this data anyway.
It's good. It's just random data I pulled off the internet. I do not vouch for any of these numbers, but and so the final one is what's the micro life change in your life between being a resident of Russia versus being a resident of Sweden per day?
That must be huge. That must be huge. I think the life expectancy in Russia is way, way lower. I think it's like in the 50s or 60s, or it's like something crazy. And in Sweden, it should be 85 to, I think it should be like around 80, 85. So that would be 20 years. So that's 20 over, let's say, 80. That would be a quarter. That we're in the hours per day.
Yeah.
So let's say maybe 6 hours.
So close. 10 hours. It's insane. And that's for men. Yeah, for women, it's 4.5 hours. So you're, as a man, you're much, much higher at risk of dying in Russia. Possibly because you're down coal mines. Although you're not getting both.
But still, even for women, 4 hours is also not... Like, you're getting 4 hours less per day if you live in Sweden versus Russia. That's bonkers.
That's insane. I'm going to spend that time sleeping. Philip, what did you bring to the table today?
Okay, I got a classic one with loads of math. And I spent about an hour trying to calculate it, failed miserably, and figured out that I missed about a factor of 10 to the power of 3 because I don't know the difference between a meter and a kilometer. So
nice.
Let's see how well you guys are doing. So my question to you is, how much energy does the sun deposit on the planet every day? Or you can also just go with power, which might be easier. So how much wattage?
So I can go at this in a random way because I vaguely remember that if we coated a small part of the Sahara Desert with solar panels to collect the sun's energy, we would power the world's the total energy consumption for humanity quite easily. So it's a very small percentage that we need to receive from the sun's energy to do all of humanity's energy needs. It's just that we couldn't pump
it. I'm not sure how that helps me.
Pump it
around. What is the unit that we're going to look at in the end? Is it joule?
It's watt. Joule per second.
In watt.
You can also end up with joule or... Yeah, I think watt or joule makes sense.
And a joule is a kilogram times meter. No, Newton times meter, my goodness. And a joule is Newton times meters. Just so I can edit this out and remove that shit.
Wait, we can do this on the size of a solar panel and the watt that the solar panel produces and the surface area of the Earth that's present in sunlight and the surface area of the Earth. So a solar panel... solar panels
I have no idea how much energy this puts out.
20% efficient.
Right.
So they're 20% efficient, and I'm trying to think of the size. I think a standard house gets about 20 kilowatt hours a day in solar on the top of a roof of a house, approximately. I'm going to guess that number, say a 20 kilowatt power array.
So what you could do here is apply the Fermi method and just try to be in an order of magnitude.
Okay, let's do that.
Just do one to the, I'm not sure, what do you want to say then? One to the two?
Mm-hmm. One to or 20 kilowatts. One to the five. Huh?
Yeah, that would be one to four, right?
Sure.
10 kilowatts would be 10 to the power of four. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, so one to the power of four is still one, right? One times
no,
10 to the four.
10 times 10 to the four. So that would be, yeah. Okay. So it's 10 to the power
What's
of four.
Per hour?
Kilowatt hours is, yeah. It's like the it's a unit of total energy because a watt is a divided by a time. Okay, so it's 10. So times the surface area. We need to know the surface area of the Earth.
So I don't think we should look at the surface area. Actually, that's kind of funny because the surface area of the Earth is part of my question.
Hey.
but in this case, we shouldn't calculate the surface area because. At this point, we should look at the Earth as a disk, and I don't want to invoke any flat Earth theory at this point. I know that's a bit of a thing for me right now, but we should look at the Earth of the disk because the curvature of the Earth leads to less energy or higher dispersion of the energy over the surface area. That's why we should consider the disk, which. And pretend they all get the equal amount of energy. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Therefore, we need the radius, which I happen to know.
We calculated that in the last one, so can you just tell us?
Last time we calculated the circumference, actually. But but sure, the radius is like 6,000... Fuck. 300 kilometers.
300, okay. Squared, right?
71, actually, yeah.
Squared.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So times that, okay.
Times pi.
Yeah, but pi doesn't make a Fermi approximation, but yeah, sure.
At this point, I don't know if we should approximate it so much because we kind of know this number, right?
Yeah, so we need to now divide it by the size of a house in kilometers. So a house is what? 0.2 kilometers square, 200 meters by 200 meters.
It's like 10 times 10 meters, maybe?
Yeah, okay, 0.01.
Is 10 meters squared 0.01 kilometers squared? I cannot do this in my head.
I think it is.
Okay, then I believe you. Are you calculating, or?
I'm not yet, I'm just writing the sequence of the calculation up, so, okay?
Right.
And it's in 24 hours, and it's... They're 20% efficient, let's assume. That's a high-end 20%, so... So we started off, was it in kilowatt hours, did we? Okay.
So you can do watt or joule per day, both. I have both numbers, I think.
But you, for a watt, oh, per day? Oh, so I'll leave out the 24 now. Okay, 1 second.
I think watt would be easiest if you have that one. So joule per second. Or energy. Basically, energy per time.
Whoa, okay. It's a big number.
That's a good sign.
Oh, shit. 1.9 times 10 to the 14 watts.
Okay, Hannes, are you also happy with that guesstimate?
I am completely happy with that, and I have no idea what this means.
Okay, so depending on what your standard is for close, you're... Close,
not
or
close.
Quite a bit off. So NASA says it's 4.4 times 10 to the power of 16. So we basically two orders of magnitude off, which is...
So off by a factor of like 100, 500, we're off?
Mm-hmm. That's pretty good.
That's...
Bearing in mind 20% efficiency...
A factor of 500 is really a lot.
But bearing in mind efficiency counts, like, not solar panels don't coat the roof, so we already made a bad estimate there. And also 20% efficiency for solar panels, I think, is the best you can get at the moment. It's not what you get.
Right.
Like,
Yeah, I also think you, I think you might have been off with the square kilometers for the roof. I'm not sure. I couldn't follow 100%. But interestingly, I basically based my estimate on exactly the same idea. So I was assuming, well, what can a solar panel of 1 meter power, which I was thinking maybe a normal light bulb, which is about 100 watts. Then I basically calculated the same thing, but I forgot that you have to take the cross section of the Earth and not half a sphere.
You have to spit. Nice.
Right.
I also assumed that the radius of the Earth was 6 kilometers instead of 6,000 kilometers. And didn't realize, which is quite embarrassing, to be honest. Yeah, but going through the... So I came out at 10 to the power of 16, which was really nice after a lot of calculating. But there's so much interesting physics involved here. So we know the wattage per square meter in space before it hits Earth quite well. It's about 1,360 watts per square meter. And then you have to think about how much is absorbed by the atmosphere and the surface is and how much is reflected. And that's quite different if you're in the Antarctic versus whatever, somewhere in Africa, because of the ice and how reflective the surface is. So there's so much interesting, cool physics going on here. But in the end, what it comes down to is that about 240 watts per square meter are actually absorbed by surface and atmosphere. And what you also read a lot is 340 watts per square meters, which is like the standard. So if you want to remember one value, 340 watts per square meter is pretty good. So that's basically on average throughout the whole year, taking into account that you have a day and a night phase and that kind of stuff. But yeah, it was really interesting. I thought there would be a really clear answer, and it's, yeah, it's quite complex. And just as a comparison, so we were saying the energy deposited on Earth is about 10 to the power of 16, and one power plant has about a gigawatt, so 10 to the power of 9, which is quite crazy. So it's like 10 to the power of 7 orders of magnitude between one power plant and what the sun is depositing every day.
Nice. Hannes, what are you up to?
It's a bit similar. It's also related to our planet. I want you to guess the volume of all water on Earth and then vaporize it and estimate the volume it would take as water vapor.
Jesus.
And while doing this, we find a number which I personally was very fascinated by when I calculated it. Maybe you're going to find the same thing. If you do, then hit the buzzer and tell me that you found the number. And in the end, we're going to encounter a problem and want to see if you also get to the same problem, if you approach it the same way as I do.
Well, okay, so you would take the volume of the Earth, and then you would think how much of the surface is covered by water and how deep on average, right? So you basically have two balls and you're trying to figure out like what's the shell of water around it, right?
And we know that the like surface of the Earth is over 50% water. Is closer to 70%? Like,
yeah, I would say 70%.
Okay.
So how deep is the Mariana Trench? That's like a couple of kilometers, right?
It's like 10,000, 11,000 meters. I think 11,000.
11,000 kilometers. Okay, so that's like
okay,
the
but that's the absolute deepest. I think most ocean is probably going to be like in the
4 kilometers.
Yeah.
So
let's go maybe four. Yeah, let's go for 4 kilometers.
We now know it's 6,300. the radius. Is it 4/3 pi r?
So what the volume
of a
yeah,
sphere is
four thirds piece r.
R square.
Four. No, it's not r square.
It can't be r squared. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, the volume, right.
To the power of 3, right?
Yeah, I approach it. No, but it's not. It's 4/3 pi r to the 3.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's what he said. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So you have a calculator, Chris, right?
I'm cheating. Yeah. Okay. Cool. I have a value of the liquid in kilometers cubed. It's a big number, but I think
so.
So there is a layer of 4 kilometers of water around the whole planet. That's your estimate.
This is the first calculation. Yeah. So that comes up at 475 million kilometers cubed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then we got to take 70% of that is actually water, right?
Yeah. Is 75 million.
It's cube kilometers. Okay. That's a nice round number.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, Hannes...
Wait, did you say 75 or 750?
75, right?
75, I've got.
Haven't you... What was your initial number? Wasn't that in the 500s or something?
Wait a second, I think I've got my brackets messed up.
475 mega cubic kilometers.
You're right, sorry, I got that wrong. It's 333 million kilometers. Okay, so that's the liquid on the planet. Can we?
Right.
Do you want to assess whether we're right now, or do you want to keep going with the volume of gas?
We can assess that, and I did basically the same thing. I just had a different guess for how deep the ocean was, but that's fine either way.
Good.
And so that's three. To put another way, that's 3.7 × 10⁸ cubic kilometers.
Yeah.
You're less than one order of magnitude away.
Yes. That's pretty good.
Is it more or less?
It's more.
Oh, really?
So it's deeper than 4 kilometers on average. Well, that makes sense, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But that's good. Let's keep going.
Okay.
So now we need to know...
How would you want to vaporize out of that? How do you calculate the volume of gas?
Oh, so one gaseous mole of a substance is 1 decimeter cubed, I think, at ideal temperature and pressure.
It at standard temperatures, I kind of hoped you would know it by heart. I'm sorry, Chris.
Sorry.
1 mole of any gas at standard conditions takes 22.4 liters.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that the Avogadro number or something?
The mole is, yes.
Oh, Jesus. Then we have to calculate density and moles and... Oh.
You don't need density. You just need... I mean, you know how many moles there are in 1 liter of water, right? That's a number a chemist knows.
Can't you just calculate it?
1 gram
is... I mean, it's H2O, right?
You can calculate it, yeah.
So then it's just
you know
18,
density, then you can calculate 16, the number, the molarity of water. But
it's 18 so, grams per mole, right?
Yeah.
And 1 liter of water is... So yeah, it's 1,000 divided by 18.
Let's say 20, then we have a nicer number. So then we would be at basically 50 moles per liter. Yeah.
Yeah, the accurate number is 55.
55 moles per liter.
And then you need to...
So 55 times 22 is something like 1,000.
Wait, what are you doing? 50 times...
55 times 22 is the number of liters of gas from that.
Or from 1 liter?
For 1 liter, yeah.
Okay, I would have calculated the moles of water on the planet first, but sure.
1,210 liters of water vapor per mole. Per liter, sorry. So we just times the number we already had by 1,210 to get the value of the gas, the volume of gas in kilometers cubed. We can just ignore all of the units because it's just a ratio, 1 to 1,200.
Oh, that's so smart.
And so it's 333. Is that a billion? Yes. 402 billion kilometers cubed.
So basically 400 giga cubic kilometers.
I don't think we should say giga cubic kilometers.
I think we should.
I like giga cubic kilometers.
What I prefer to do is to have one digit and then give times 10 to the whatever. So when you say 402 times 10 to the 9, I say 4 times 10 to the 11.
Yeah.
Because I think it makes comparison easier if you just to keep one digit.
Full and have to say have to give it in cubic meters instead of cubic kilometers.
Why?
I mean, if you go for the scientific one, that would be.
Oh right, yes. No, we can still stay in kilometers like this if you as long as you compare.
Only halfway.
Right.
I see.
So, okay, so I'm
10 gonna say cubed.
You're still obviously you're still. In the true value that I calculated as well, based on the true numbers, because you knew the molarity of water, right? So therefore, what you found now is still within one order of magnitude.
Nice. So,
which is interesting.
So, are you saying your final value is the one you calculated? You don't have a Wikipedia reference or something?
Oh. What? No, I don't think people did that bit. But I have a Wikipedia reference for the amount of water on Earth, of course. And then if you vaporize it, that's kind of standard physical chemistry. Like, there's nothing you have to do other than... And that's where the problem comes in. But let me tell you about the number I found while doing that, which you skipped, Chris, and then this was interesting. So what you did is you had a volume of water, and you calculated the ratio of how much this water expands if it becomes liquid. And you did this... as an example on 1 liter. How much does 1 liter of water expand if you vaporize it? How much more space does it take up? And the relationship, which might not be obvious to all the listeners, is volume that 1 mole of any substance takes up, because this is actually independent of the substance. One mole is a certain number of molecules, which is 6 × 10²³, and that's a lot, right? So if you have 1 mole of helium atoms, they take up the same space at the same standard conditions, which is 1 bar and 22 degrees. They take up the same space as water molecules, for example. That's because heavier atoms move slower and therefore create less force, so they don't expand as much. Right, Chris?
Yeah, under ideal conditions.
Would you agree here? Yeah. So for under ideal conditions... this number for 1 mole of gas is 22.4 liters. We can calculate that. What I did then is I took a bit of a detour is from the volume of water, which was this 300 something million cubic kilometers. I calculated how many liters this would be. And then I calculated how many moles these are. Mm-hmm. And if you do this of the true value, so the true value of water on Earth would be 1 × 3 × 10⁹ cubic kilometers. So that's roughly 1.3 billion cubic kilometers. That's a lot, right?
Yeah, that's a lot.
But then consider if this is in liters, we have to like times this a lot. This 1.3 × 10²² liters.
Oh.
And this comes down to 7.1 × 10²³ moles of water on Earth. So we have more than 1 mole of moles of water on the planet.
Nice.
This is fantastic.
So nice to remember. We actually also forgot completely about all the water that is not in the oceans.
You can basically ignore that because 96% of all water is salt water in the oceans.
Oh, nice. It's 4% of water. And that 4% of water is actually the only one we care about. So.
Yeah, exactly.
That is a very it's also the one that is view of the world. I think if we talked to a dolphin, I would not be impressed with that.
I want to see you drink salt water, and then we can talk about it.
I mean, the big issue is that most fresh water is actually ice on the poles, and if they melt, they mix with salt water and therefore become also unusable for us, right? That's the big issue.
Yeah, true. But I'm quite impressed with us. We were... close
we,
from such a I'm very basic
I'm not quite done actually because if we follow this thought experiment of vaporizing all the water on Earth we notice something.
Well, I mean,
so the value
are you getting
value,
it that it doesn't work at all because you can't vaporize it at standard
temperature? That's not fair.
Yeah, no, but that's the point, is that the value we found is like 4 × 10⁻¹ cubic kilometers. The most accurate value would be 1 × 10⁻¹², so that's 1.6 trillion cubic kilometers, where the atmosphere itself, depending on how you define it, is 5 to 8 × 10⁻¹ cubic kilometers. So the atmosphere, the volume of the vaporized oceans or all of water on the planet would be larger than the atmosphere that we have right now by a factor of 100.
But I mean, that makes a lot of sense, right?
It does. It does. But I think it only does once you calculate it.
Air is not uniformly distributed, right?
No, exactly. So you couldn't define that volume, or that this volume would behave differently because the atmosphere would change. So we would create a completely new atmosphere, which would be
very wet.
Probably much more than 100 times bigger than what we have right now.
So I was imagining just the water floating in space and then creating its own gravity. But you could also...
Oh, you think that the bubble of water would float away?
Yeah, exactly.
No, I think it would become a new atmosphere. Or part of the existing one.
Well, I mean, like, it's a nice thing to think about, and it's mathematically it maybe makes sense, but like when you come to the reality, none of it makes any sense whatsoever.
No,
because
of course.
Then you would
I
have like what 100%. Like, it wouldn't even be humidity, right? It would just be water. There would be no air.
Yeah, that's the point, right? It would then condense and turn liquid and
make
rain.
Oceans.
Yeah, of course. I guess if you created a situation where the Earth is hot enough or too hot for water to become liquid. Like with heat, also the humidity increases.
Then it's not at 22 degrees anymore.
Exactly. So all of this doesn't work anymore. But you could, like, if you would assume a new temperature, you could model a new atmosphere for the planet.
Yeah, true. Interesting.
And that would be, I'm completely unequipped to do that, but it would be interesting to see what that would look like.
Yeah, definitely a fun calculating exercise. That was a really good trick, Chris, to just get the ratio and calculate it.
Nice.
It's nice. Yeah, this was fun.
It was good.
So a problem I encountered when doing the mass of water on the Earth, but also with Philip's guess, the power output or the power input of the sun on the Earth, is that, so what I try to do is this Fermi approximation, which means that you guess a number of parameters and you only guess them in the order of magnitude. But in both cases, there was only one of them. And that's where the system breaks down. If you have many of them and you only approximate them to the next order of magnitude, so the next multiple of 10, it kind of averages out and you end up with a good guess. If we only have one of these variables, that's this kind of system breaks down, and then you're still off by quite a bit.
I mean, you guessed a couple of things. You guessed how much square meters has like a standard solar panel. You guessed what's the wattage that one can do. That kind of stuff.
Right.
So I think it's still
works, true.
But
this
you're
case
right
was two.
That it works better if you have more variables. They kind of counteract, like the errors counteract each other. That's
for sure. If you have more unknowns. Thank you for listening. We're back in 2 weeks when we have a look into publishing and peer review with our guest Pedro from Pedromics. If you want to send comments, questions or feedback, you can get in touch on Twitter at frnpodcast or email under contact@frn-podcast.com. If you want to support the show, consider becoming a patron. You can find us on Patreon under frnpodcast, or you can find a link on our website at frn-podcast.com. Music credits go to Jake Patterson. Thank you for listening, and see you for the next one.